Sea level rise has been called the single greatest impact of climate change. But if we are learning, sea level can go up regionally for other reasons. Surprising new research shows the ocean rose along the coast of New England, for example, by almost 4 inches for a couple of years. Here to explain why is Paul B. Goddard. He's working on his PhD in climatology and climate modeling at the University of Arizona. More recently, Paul was the lead author of a paper in the journal Nature Communications that was titled An Extreme Event of Sea Level Rise Along the Northeast Coast of North America in 2009-2010. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
There were several surprises for me in your new paper. First of all, though, what stimulated you to do this research?
Sure. My advisor, Zhengjin Yin, has actually looked at this type of process occurring in climate models. So he knew that when a study came out in 2012 showing a decrease in the ocean circulation, he knew from his climate model study that this may mean increased sea level rise along the East Coast. So when we had the observations of the ocean circulation changing, he had me look to see if there was a signal on the Northeast Coast and the actual observations of the tide gauge data. So that's how we began.
And how much did the ocean go up around New England starting in 2009?
Yeah, so we calculated from New York City up to Newfoundland, the average increase in the 2 years from 2009 to 2010 was about 94 millimeters, with the highest being 128 millimeters at Portland, Maine. This was quite a significant increase. We didn't find anything like this in the record dating back to the early 1900s.
Wow, that's almost 5 inches at the highest point there. Well, surely local fishermen and other officials noticed such a big rise in the seas. Were there any impacts?
Yeah, so we looked through some of the literature that had been written up, and most of the studies that showed, you know, coastal erosion or flood inundation along the coast, they were mostly studied in the North Carolina region or Maryland, but nothing much north of New York City. I'm not sure if it was just, you know, less people looking there for a signal, but actually from our research, this area north of New York City actually got more of the signal than what was in the Mid-Atlantic region, which was getting most of the press. So that was a little strange to find.
So here's my first surprise. I've been told by experts, including scientists on Radio EcoShock, that the major cause of sea level rise in places like New York City was subsidence, that the land was still sinking along the coast after the glaciers departed. Is coastal New England sinking, and how does that relate to what you found?
Yeah, so coastal New England, as well as down the Mid-Atlantic region, there is some land subsidence, either due from the past glacial maximum, you know, the retreat of the glaciers, or from groundwater pumping and things. And it's a really big issue in the Chesapeake Bay region. However, these changes are only on a few millimeters per year. And what we saw from 2009 to 2010, again, it was like a change of about 40 to 50 millimeters per year. So a full order of magnitude larger. So therefore, the land subsidence cannot explain everything that was happening during this time.
Well, that brings me to the second most important point, I think, and that's just how complicated assigning the causes of sea level rise can be. If it wasn't subsidence, what did cause New England seas to go up those 128 millimeters or 5 inches in some places?
Yeah, so we tied it to two different things in the climate system. One was the actual ocean circulation in the Atlantic slowing down, as well as atmospheric changes in the North Atlantic, which changed wind patterns over that. And I feel we can get into that a little bit further on.
Okay. Now, do climate scientists add in ocean circulation, like you've been talking about, in their models, like the ones used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Yeah. The climate models that are used by the IPCC are fully coupled, so they have fully interactive ocean atmosphere, and they do a fairly good job of representing the circulation across the entire globe, and this IPCC report uses the best results out there, and it's the best conclusions we have thus far, but, you know, we're always working towards making the models better.
All right, Paul Goddard, I'm assuming your work is closely related to another paper, and that's the one in Ocean Science led by H.L. Bryden. The title is Impact of a 30% Reduction in Atlantic Meridional Overturning During 2009-2010. Scientists call that AMOC for short, and that's certainly easier to pronounce. Please explain what Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation is.
Yeah, it's a great question. So the Atlantic Meridional Return Circulation, or like you said, AMOC, is the circulation that travels in the Atlantic Ocean, travels from the south at the surface, across the equator, and actually the Gulf Stream is part of the AMOC, so that warm water off the Atlantic coastline is part of the AMOC, the Gulf Stream. And then as the Gulf Stream heads north, it loses some heat, and when it gets up into the Labrador Sea and the Greenland Sea and the Iceland Sea, it's become cold enough and dense enough that it can sink. And this sinking is what is part of the overturning part, the overturning as far as going from the surface towards the bottom of the ocean. And then it returns to the South Atlantic and all the way down to the Southern Ocean where Antarctic is at depth. So that's called the Atlantic Meridional Overturn Circulation. And its relationship to the sea level rise event is if you picture the Gulf Stream flowing away from the coastline, to your right is to the south and to the left is to the north, and there's actually quite a steep sea surface height gradient between the two. And if that sea surface height gradient decreases at all, there is a change in the sea level height on the coastline. So that's what actually we saw in 2009 and 2010 was this decrease in the gradient or the decrease in the AMOC strength, which caused an increase in sea level rise. So it is kind of a tongue twister to get through it all, but it's all there.
I was astounded to find in that Bryden paper that this North Atlantic ocean current system is, quote, accounting for 25% of the maximum combined atmosphere-ocean heat transport necessary to balance the Earth's radiation budget, end quote. 25% is a huge number. What happens if this system slows down?
Yeah, that's one of the rare things about the Atlantic circulation is how much heat it does transport northward. You know, a lot of people may be familiar with the idea that the Gulf Stream brings heat to Europe. And so a change in the Gulf Stream flow, you know, may change the heat transport in that region as well. So, you know, the flow is going to always happen as long as there are winds because winds push the currents around. But any kind of change in the net heat transport could definitely dramatically change the heat budget of the entire Earth.
Right. And getting back to your own paper, Paul Goddard, has the sea level now gone down around New England?
Yeah. So basically, at the current state, it is below where the peak was in 2010. However, it's still higher than where it started off at in 2008. And so what we studied was basically this huge fluctuation that happened between 2008 and 2010. So the long-term trend of the sea level rise is still increasing. However, the year-to-year fluctuation can be superimposed on that, and that's what we were looking at.
I think you mentioned this, but how rare is such a big sea level change driven by changes in ocean circulation?
Yeah, so one of the fascinating things that we found was if you looked at the number, that 94 millimeters in 2 years along the northeast coast, that statistically is equivalent to a 1-in-850-year event. So, in other words, very rare for something like that to happen.
Do climate models show this kind of event becoming more rare or happening more often?
Yeah, so with the climate models, we looked at some experiments that basically look at a doubling of the CO2 in the atmosphere, which, you know, we project that to occur towards the end of this century from 2070 to 2100. So with this increase of CO2, we do expect the sea level extreme events that we saw in the Northeast to increase in frequency and in magnitude.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with scientist Paul Goddard from the University of Arizona. You also credit a second force, as you mentioned, or a cycle for this historic sea level burst around New England, and that's the Significant Relative North Atlantic Oscillation Index, another tongue twister. Please explain what that is and what happened.
Yes, and I'll try to make this as simple as I can. So the North Atlantic Oscillation is an atmospheric mode, and it deals with air pressure differences in the North Atlantic. And the easiest way to think of this is when the North Atlantic is in a negative mode, like it was during the 2009-2010, it means that winds along the northeast shore of North America are either blowing towards the coastline or along the coast. And both of those result in net transport of water to the coast, or in other words, kind of pushing the waters up to the coast, making a sea level rise.
I think that makes sense. I can understand that. Well, now, another key reason I thought your paper was important is this. What if ocean circulation brings another big hike in sea levels at the same time as a big storm surge event like Hurricane Sandy. Wouldn't Sandy flooding have been worse if it had happened in 2009 or 2010?
Yeah, of course. Basically, any time that you superimpose a storm on a high tide or a sea level extreme event like this, you're going to end up with more coastal inundation and extreme impact. So I would say yes with that.
All right. So it's important that we know about these things because they could affect a lot of human lives. I have to ask you, Paul, why are you at the landlocked University of Arizona working on ocean levels?
Yeah, so when I, looked around at graduate programs, the one at U of A, they actually have a really good climate modeling group here, which is unusual for a university. Most of the climate modeling groups are run by, industry such or government agencies such as NCAR or GFDL in Princeton. But here at the University of Arizona, we actually have the capabilities of running climate models. So it was very interesting to find that out, as well as some amazing climate scientists out here already, such as my advisors, Jun-Jin Yin and Joellen Russell and Jonathan Overpeck, and the list goes on and on. It's just a great place to do climate research out here. And a sea level rise should be a concern everywhere, so it doesn't really matter if you're along a coast or not.
Well, again, on a personal level, I'm finding more cases where PhD candidates are putting out cutting-edge research, often as lead authors. We've had three of them, in fact, this year on the show. Even before getting a doctorate or becoming a professor, do you think that's a new trend, or what does it tell us about science?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things that come to mind. I think, one, there's just so many questions to be answered right now in the climate system. Things are changing at, an accelerated rate, something that we haven't seen in the past, as well as we have the technology now to understand them and hopefully get the public and policymakers in line and involved in these types of investigations. So that's certainly one of the major things. I would say that young climatologists have a very bright future.
Well, to be blunt, I think it's also a case where it used to be that the PhD candidates did the work and then the lead author name went to whoever was in charge. And I think that's changing too, that people are saying, well, okay, you're doing the work, you're getting your name on the paper.
Yeah.
Now, the whole subject of how the ocean works is coming into a kind of renaissance. It seems to me, Paul, we're coming to appreciate at least two things: how much we don't know about the ocean, and that the ocean is probably the single biggest factor driving climate in the coming centuries. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the ocean is Earth's pacemaker. It covers 70% of the land. It's the large reservoir for heat as well as CO2 gas. It's really what on long-term scales affects the climate system. So I feel strongly that the ocean is really where you need to look for to make the big claims of what's changing in the climate system.
It is the key, but of course media is more focused on everything we humans do on land, so it's hard to get the word out there on what's happening on the oceans.
Yeah, it's almost like exploring space. There's so much of the ocean that we haven't discovered yet, but that we are starting to, which is great. We're continuously starting to get funding to put floats and buoys out that track certain systems of the ocean that we never had before. So hopefully the future brings a lot more ideas and more knowledge to the general public about what's going on in the ocean and how they're impacting it or what they may do to help out.
It's the new frontier. What will you be researching next, Paul?
Well, I'm definitely going to continue looking at the East Coast and the impacts of sea level rise there. I'm actually working right now on some things with the Southern Ocean because it's inherently tied with what's going on in the North Atlantic, believe it or not. So just trying to look at the whole world as a whole and figure out what we can all do.
Great. We've been talking with Paul Goddard from the University of Arizona. He's the lead author of the paper, An Extreme Event of Sea Level Rise Along the Northeast Coast of North America in 2009-2010. That was published February 14th, 2015 in the journal Nature Communications. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. This was great.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. I'm Alex. Check out our webpage at ecoshock.org. Look at the show blog with all the links at ecoshock.info and our busy page on SoundCloud, heading past 20,000 listeners in just our first year in the cloud. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.